You mentioned Ian Cantor there and joining. I didn't know that you joined Investec part-time in the late 70s and then you joined full-time in the 80s.
So I did a joint venture with them. I was in an accounting, my dad's accounting firm in Benoni.
Right.
Which I joined in 1976. And
out of varsity, straight out of articles.
Articles, yeah.
Yeah.
My first job out of articles. And I went to help him because he was quite old and I thought I'd help him in his practice. He had other partners, but still. And then, you know, in 1978, I started a 50-50 company called Investec Leasing East Rand. Because I was out there in Benoni and there were professionals that I would go and encourage to use Investec to finance them. And Bernard, similarly, was in a joint venture with them in another business. And so we came all together in 1980. When we bought the bank, we bought Cape Trustees and Executors, and then I came full time.
So was it? So the way you kind of hooked up, was it Ian Cantor that approached you to do the leasing?
I was a friend with Larry Nested. We grew up together.
Right.
Because it was Ian, Larry, and Errol Grohlman. But I knew Ian because I used to visit Larry a lot, and then I was instrumental in writing letters to 8 banks to ask them if they were for sale. I don't know what, one day I was like, they need a bank, because they were originating loans and selling them to other banks. And so I wrote letters and one said, yes, we're under attack from a hostile buyer, we'll talk to you. And it was Cape Trustees, which was a liquidation business, but a bank as well.
Right.
And they didn't want the bank.
So that's how you got the license.
So they want, but the liquidators wanted their liquidation practice. So they took the liquidation practice, and we bought the bank.
So coming back to what I called what made Investec go, the first thing was a group of like-minded entrepreneurs. Would that be fair?
Yeah, look, I can remember walking. We used to be in downtown,
Chobig and Fox Street.
Yeah, no. We were first Anderson Street, 162 Anderson Street, because our institutional partner was HCI. The same HCI that owns the casinos, they used to own insurance businesses, IGI and IGI Life. And IGI itself actually ultimately went broke, which we learned a lot of lessons from. But they were a 30% shareholder of Investec, and we were in their building. And we were a tenant in their building. And in fact, original Investec, before it was called Investec, was called Hoskins Consolidated Leasing, which Ian ran from 1974 to 1976. And Larry and Errol bought it in 1976 and created the name Investec. So we really, if you go back to our early days, it was, 1974, when Ian was the CEO of Hoskins Consolidated Leasing. But that ultimately became Investec Limited. So, and then we bought Cape Trustees, which became Investec Bank. So Ian, one day we were walking from, because he used to go to the Carlton Centre for meetings. They had the Carlton Court Hotel. Ian loved going to the dining room or the lounge there for meetings. And he was walking back and he said to me, one day, and this was in 1980, will be like Salomon Brothers. And in those days, you read last poker.
Right.
Salomon Brothers
was the god of
the Goldmans of what Goldmans is today.
Today, right, yeah.
And he said, what you? And he said, we'll do this 40 million rand loans and structured loans. And I said, what rubbish are you talking? We're lending 10,000 rand to a doctor to buy Mercedes. That's what a Mercedes cost in those days. Okay, and an accountant, that's who we were lending money to. And we had like some fleet leasing to mid-sized corporates. That's what we did all day. And he was talking about this, doing these big structured finance, project finance type transactions. And then, we started a trading room. Then we merged with Medboard, so we got the wealth management business. And then they also had two unit trusts, the property unit trust, which is now part of Growthpoint, was Medprop, and Medboard Equity Fund, which is Investec Asset Management's equity fund. And then, from there we were buying businesses to build scale, starting different channels to create the format we got today. which is, you know, the banking business. But we started out, we still have that business that lends money to doctors, accountants, and other professions. It's part of our private bank. And when you
started growing up, though, there's this big differentiator that I've certainly found at Investec, that this focus on organizational development and cultures and values.
Yeah.
So when did that thinking start?
It started quite early. We had a guy, Alan Zimler, was a professor of organizational behavior at WITS, and he used to provide us consulting services, mainly in the management team, which was really, you know, at that stage, mainly Bernard, myself, Errol Brahman, and Ian. And we had one or two other guys, Glenn was there. And we used to, you know, how do you manage conflict? How do you, you know, how do you structure your organization? Do we have titles? Don't we have titles? Keep our structure flat. And he brought, you know, I would call new age thinking to us, that, you know, how to run an organization. And then we built on that over many, many years to create. He eventually came at us full time, then he moved to London and led it in London. And, you know, from that we started building this culture and this value system within the organization. And then you learn from different kinds of people. I think one of the guys we learned the most from was an Indian guy called by the name of Professor Samantra Ghoshal. And he described two types of organizations. He said, what is the smell of the place? And he came from Calcutta, and he said he's a downtown Calcutta in the middle of summer, where it's 99 degrees Fahrenheit, humidity 104 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade, and all you can do is lie inside and sleep. Compared to Fontainebleau Forest, because he taught at INSEAD, which is in just outside of Paris,
yeah,
in spring, where it's very energy. You get a lot of energy if you go into the forest. You don't feel lazy. You feel like you want to do things. And then he said, you know, look at your organization. Are you creating downtown Calcutta in summer? And he says, you know, Calcutta in autumn and in spring is a great place to be, but summer not. And or Fontainebleau Forest in spring. And he said, the one downtown Calcutta in summer has, you know, the key things of running the organization: control, compliance, constraint, contract. Okay, so very bureaucratic. Versus Fontainebleau Forest, stretch, discipline, and a lot of that discipline is self-discipline, or living within the confines of the organizational parameters. Trust, you trust your people. Support, you support your people. You don't build a culture of blame. So, you know, if something went wrong, you know, while I see you, I'm responsible. It's not someone else's issue. Even though it may have been done by someone else, you know, I'm responsible. So it's building, and you create two very different organizations. So we've always tried to create, you know, the Fontainebleau Forest, where people are energetic, enthusiastic, want to help their clients, want to look after their clients, want to get things done. And that's where our culture emanates from. Very clear values, you know, like integrity. We don't say we just want integrity, we want cast iron integrity, because integrity is, if you bend it, it breaks. Cost down, if you bend it, it breaks. You know, break China for the client. It means go out of your way to deliver to the client. Open and honest dialogue. So if I've got a problem with anyone, I tell them. I don't go and tell the world that I've got a problem with the individual, and the individual doesn't even know they've got a problem. So, you know, these are the kinds of, you know, making a contribution to society, very important part of our values. We don't live off society, we live in it. So we have to make sure that we make a contribution and help uplift people from poverty in our way.
When it came to acquisitions, capital allocation, you had, and the mission statement of the bank, that changed over the years as well.
Yeah, but it's not too far. So we had a core purpose.
Yeah.
Okay, which is to help people create wealth and manage their wealth. So it's very, the banking side you help create.
Yeah.
The wealth and the asset management side you help manage. Okay. And then, you know, our mission was to be a distinctive specialist bank and asset manager, living by our core values. At some stage we used to say an international, in the earlier days, international investment bank. But then, you know, we modified it to get to where we are today, which is distinctive, which means we want to do things with distinction and differentiate ourselves. Specialist bank, we operate in a multiple channels, but we're not all things to people, all people. And then, you know, and asset manager, which covers the wealth management side, which is, you know, both for private clients, which is our wealth and investment business, and institutional clients, which is the asset management business. So that's how it evolved over the years.
You also made some entries into the, if I think back, the United States, Israel, and I think you mentioned Australia,
yeah,
with varying degrees of success. What are some of the reasons that you didn't get to full-scale businesses in those
areas? We weren't a bank in the US, we were a broker, and we still got a business in the US. Both asset management have quite a big distribution business. If you look up, you see quite a lot of the money that they manage, not all of it, you know, a reasonable percentage is US originated. They don't many do invest in the US, they invest in emerging markets, in fixed income, in global equities, you know, quite what they call quality equities. So there may be US companies that they may invest in, but we were building what was more like an investment bank in the US with a wealth management arm. We found a culture very different to what you're accustomed to here or the UK. And that ultimately we decided to sell we had a clearing business, we sold that. We got quite a lot of money back for that. That was quite a good business. And then we had a private client broker. Very different culture. And, you know, their culture is how much commission am I going to earn? Whereas, you know, in South Africa and in the UK, we don't work on commission. Look after the client and you might get a share of the profits of the business, which is a very different incentive. And then it encourages you to behave appropriately towards a client, which is, so we ultimately, in 2004, we sold those businesses, 2003, 2004. Israel was a different story. It was, you know, we had just listed, we had to reshape our business, and for some reason or other, we decided to sell, because the return on equity was a bit low, and we had a building in Rothschild Boulevard, which is one of the elite areas in Tel Aviv. If we'd kept that business, we would have shot the lights out. It was a mistake, because that was in the second intifada of the economy. It's the last time they were in a recession. They've still since then grown by, you know, probably 4% per annum. Their GDP when we bought them was below $100 billion. It's now $375 billion. And our building is worth at least six times what it was in our books at. So that I would regard as a mistake, but, you know, we were under pressure at the time to reshape. And then Australia, we had a separately capitalized bank. We bought both the Israeli bank and the Australian bank from the Rothschilds. We built a very strong private bank that dealt with doctors and accountants, mainly similar to the strategy we had here. And we were a little bit worried that the large Australian banks, which dominate that system, would come in and eat our lunch. So we sold it to Bank of Queensland for twice book. Everyone was telling us it's worthless. We sold it for twice book. Book value was $200 million. We sold it for $400 million. And we now in the process of creating a branch in Australia, but the business in Australia, there are 100 people, and asset management have a further, I don't know, 5-6 people, because they also look after that region from Australia. The guy who lives in Australia, looks after the region. He came from Investec in South Africa. It's a corporate business. We do advice, so we have a good corporate advisory franchise. We fund, you know, project finance, private equity firms, corporates, we do, you know, provide forex and treasury services, and then we also have some entrepreneurial activities. So it's quite a nice franchise, well-rounded, so we still have that business. and the people there have been with us a long time. Some of them work for us here. Actually, ex-Australian, an Australian runs it, but he worked for us for 10 years between South Africa and London. So he knows our culture well, very good guy. So it's a nice little boutique, and there's a lot of expats there that we can service. But it will, we're in the process of making it a branch. So why the problem with owning a separately capitalized bank is exactly what you said right at the beginning, is the scale required to recover the cost of compliance is very, very onerous.
Best business decision you ever made?
No, there are lots of good ones. Yeah, I think there are lots of good ones and there are a few bad ones. So I think, you know, we bought Cos Shepherd in, I can't remember what year, 94, 95. That gave us a wealth management platform. Guinness Marn, perhaps, when we bought Guinness Flight. No one here actually saw it. But Guinness Flight was owned 43 or 42% by Guinness Marn.
This is in the UK,
in
right?
In the UK.
This is a stockbroking.
Guinness Flight was a global asset manager.
Asset manager, right.
And 42% or 41%, I think they had each 41 each, by Hambros PLC. And then management had 18%. So when we bought Guinness Marn, we bought Guinness Flight.
Okay.
For 41%. But we didn't have the other 59%. So we then went and did a deal with Sir Chips where we bought Hambros PLC, which was listed. And we had a recommended offer for Hambros PLC. Management in the meantime of Guinness Marn, which was Howard Flight and Tim Guinness, wanted, they had private equity backing to buy us out. But they hadn't realized that we'd already done a deal with Sir Chips. So we pincered them and then we bought their 18%. And I can still remember them coming to this office where we're sitting next door here with their advisor, and I think it was Tim Guinness who came to see me. Said, here, we've got an offer for you. I said, sorry, here's our recommended offer for Hambros PLC. So we're going to own 82, we'll buy your share. And that was the foundation for Investec Asset Management in the UK.
Okay.
And that now is, out of the £110 billion they manage, over £70 billion is from that business. At the time, that business managed £7 billion, but half of that was money funds. Now they have a fully diversified asset management business. So I would say that was the best decision we made, because we weren't able to do due diligence. Ken Costa, the guy from UBS, ex-South African who was selling it, said,
Now or never.
We didn't have the kind of governance yet today. So
you could make an on-the-spot decision.
Well, we spoke to, obviously, our chairman and some of our board members, but we said yes. And he said to me, fortune favors the brave. Also, like when we gave Joffy 7 million rand when he started Bidvest. Should have just kept the shares. I would have made probably, I worked out 12 billion from that 7 million. But we always, you know, we sold
them. Where's decision, Stephen?
When we sold Bidvest and then we had quite a big stake in Aspen, 42 million shares, and wasn't our real decision. Now, maybe that wasn't so bad. The worst decision, the tough decisions that we really had to work very hard on fixing was the acquisition of Fetcher, where we had 3,000 people. We had to cut it down to 100 and spin it off. So a bit went to asset management, a bit went to our property business. We sold a piece off to Capital Alliance. It was a very tough deal. Okay. Eventually, I think we did okay out of it, but it put us through trauma. And the other one was Kensington Mortgages,
right. Which
we bought in 2007 in May, and the world started collapsing just after. In fact, I got a call from Goldman's to say they're going to bid against us, because it was in the period as a public company, and I went mad. I was screaming at Goldman, how can you bid against us? We're your client. And then, you know, the world tipped, so they didn't bid against us. I'm sorry they never bid against us, but still. So I think that was the toughest thing.
I had those down as the two toughest. Fetcher and Kensington.
Key, if I could call, missteps.
Best, most impressive entrepreneur you've ever met?
Yeah, I think there are lots of them, but you know, obviously there's Joffy, who I saw build a great business from nothing. You know, he came to us first in, I think it was 89, I can't remember the exact date.
You gave him a couple of million rand at the time? Invested a couple of million rand?
Invested 7 for 20%. So we had, he'll argue that we invested 7 for 20. And that enabled him to buy Chipkins. He had other investors. And from that Chipkins acquisition, which they still own.
The packaging business, huh?
No, that was food service.
Food services.
So that's part of Bidcorp now. I think they merged Chipkins with some Belgian crowd. But the food service business, which I'm now chairman of, you know, has businesses all over the world. And then you've got Bidvest, which is the industrial business.
Businesses.
That's primarily South Africa with one or two businesses outside South Africa. So you know, I can remember from that day when we first did the deal with him, which we did in a restaurant, you know, to where that business is today till he demerged the two. But even if you look at the two, you know, they are both doing quite well. And so I would put him up there. You know, you've seen other very good entrepreneurs, but you know, you've got to build sustainable businesses. So you've seen guys start business, you know, oh, look what he's done with Discovery, but he wasn't one of our clients when he did that. He was backed by the guys across the road.
Right. Another one I have to ask you about is Marcus Huster. I mean, the community in South Africa, the business community is fairly small. You're a banker, you know these guys. How much of a shock was that to you to learn what had happened there? I mean, did it shake your faith in your instinct? I know you always talk about, you know,
I was always a bit
getting a smell of the place.
I was wary of the guy because he was very, very clever, very clever. But he got so big that you had to deal with him as a, you know, and one thought that he traded out of the problem. Because if you look back 20 years, you'd say, but you know, you thought, okay, this is a big global business, and everyone was chasing him. And I think with hindsight, I'm not shocked, but with hindsight's an exact science.
Sure.
But yes, I was clever, and there's nothing he couldn't answer with a straight face. So, you know, there's some very strong business people who had a lot of shares in him. We actually spoke to him a month before the thing blew up. He sold it, and I thought, no, we don't have to worry. This oak knows what he's doing. So, it was a hard one to pick up. Other than, you know, there are people who said, well, they didn't invest in him because they didn't trust him. You know, they're all clever now, but most people were there.
Absolutely.
And it was a mess. And then, you know, to go from, at one stage that share was 90, I see it's 1.90 or something like that today. That's a wipeout, eh?
No, absolutely. I mean, the fact that he was able to persuade Christo Visa to invest with him as well.
Yeah, and he put in proper business and he was about to roll ShopRite in. So,
just kind of finishing off, Stephen, and thank you again for your time. You know, what would you like? Where would you like to see Investec go in the next 20 years?
So look, I think, you know, what we've been trying to do. Okay, we're now demerging asset management. I think, you know, I think it's got great people, a great franchise, it can go to great heights as it become maybe one of the top global asset managers. If, you know, they can sustain the momentum. They're not a South African business. South Africa's 30-odd% of what they are. And as I said, I gave the example, you know, from 1998, since the acquisition of Guinness Flight, you know, 1998 we had nothing. Okay, we only started asset management in its form early 92.
Yeah.
Indra joined us end of 91. So, you know, that's a 27-year story. And then you've got, you know, what we call specialist bank and wealth. I think we're making good inroads into the UK. South Africa is going to be competitive, but you know, hopefully the country starts growing again. As an element of South Africa that we haven't penetrated properly, which we call Investec for Business, I think that can be a big business. The private bank, you know, we know that we're getting competition, but we've always had competition. These guys, we've got strong competition in the bank environment, and you know, if we can sustain our culture and our value system, I think it can still continue to grow from strength to strength. We're building out the private bank in the UK. The guy who runs it, Karan Tola, making great progress. He ran the private bank here, and you can see the excitement in the eyes of the people when you physically go there. The corporate bank has always done well in the UK. You know, it got a smack a little bit in the financial crisis, but it wasn't too bad. We recovered pretty quick. You know, now we just have to get our returns to the right kind of level. So shall I stop complaining? But when you're building out a business, you know, sometimes you're investing, and we write off what we invest. So we don't. So you need to carry that. I think we can get tighter on costs here and there. And I think, you know, the new guys will be better than that, than me and Bernard. Because me and Bernard, you know, we're entrepreneurs. We want to support people. We want to, you know, build a brand and all that kind of stuff. So we won't be as clinical about it. But, you know, this generation maybe will be more professional than we were. But they must try and keep the culture of entrepreneurship. Otherwise, you lose an edge. So, but I do think, you know, that the new generation can take Investec to another level. They've got a strong platform. And, you know, with that strong platform, you know, they keep doing the right thing over a long period of time, you'll see it continue to grow strongly. Markets are tough. You know, in the UK, you've got Brexit. In South Africa, we still got, you know, we're seeing all the stuff pour out on state capture. And you can see the pressure on state-owned enterprises and capacity of government and confidence of consumer and confidence of corporates. But, you know, I think you're at the turning point. Uncle just needs to keep his eye on the ball. And we can do great things here. So, hopefully, you know, Brexit goes the right way and South Africa turns properly, and then, you know, all the noise disappears.